Hello and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. The battle over pesticide use in Hawaii has found other than legal channels to change behavior. Since 2014, engineer and landscape manager Dwayne Sparkman has actively used alternatives to glyphosates, heavy metal fertilizers, and neonicotinoids at the Westin Maui Resort and Spa. He'll be one of the featured speakers at a Maui workshop series starting tomorrow. It's part of a year-long pilot program to maintain 4 pesticide-free parks on Maui and offer help to residents to change how they maintain their lawns and gardens. Dwayne Sparkman joins us now by phone. Aloha.
Aloha and mahalo for having me.
And thanks for being here. Now, we've talked a lot about organic farming and what goes into that. But when you look at it from the perspective of maintaining golf courses or big swaths of lawn, what has to change in the behavior for someone to see that that is truly pesticide-free?
Well, it's really choosing the proper type of grass, yeah, and then also choosing the proper ways to deal with it. It's really having a really healthy soil profile and keeping those things really resistant to the bugs so you don't have to apply these pesticides and chemicals.
So talk about the grass a little bit, because people have different preferences for grass and how they want to see their lawns and what gives them pleasure when they look out at their garden. For them to keep it pesticide-free, what kind of grass do you recommend?
Well, I mean, in some areas won't allow you to have seashore paspalum because it actually goes against some of the community, laws that they have, because they might be near a golf course. And so I prefer to use seashore paspalum because it's so easy to use organically. You can use it with a type of compost as opposed to a fertilizer, and then you can use salt applied directly to the weeds, and that will fight the weeds as opposed to using chemicals.
You make the point that some developments have very strict rules about what you can and what you can't do. How is this beginning to move into that arena, as you've now been using this in the hotel for 4 years, at least on Maui? Do you have any evidence that people are starting to look at how they're just governing their own developments a little differently when it comes to lawns and grass?
Well, they are. The hardest part is any near golf course areas. Seashore paspalum can be considered invasive on other golf courses. So because of the grass that they have there, seashore paspalum has a tendency to go in and take over on Bermudas and things like that that you would have in a golf course. So some areas, they are very restrictive to that. But a lot of the other areas that are far away from there have completely allowed seashore paspalum into their neighborhoods with no problems. So that's been a very plus benefit for all of us.
So what do golf courses do then, since they're using very different grass and presumably you would like to see them also be pesticide-free? What can they do?
Well, see, that's the hard part, is it's such a large area. And so I've been in the residential and resort game for a really long time, and it's a lot smaller. Grass is easy to maintain. We're not as close to the resort, so we're allowed to have the seashore paspalum on our properties. So I'm anxious to see what Beyond Pesticides has for all the big golf course production here. So I'm actually excited to have them here to get a little bit more education on what they plan on doing with these big giant golf courses.
You're talking about a national nonprofit that's also coming to speak at the workshop series.
That's correct.
At this point, have you had any preliminary conversation with them to find out how they're approaching golf courses and what might we be able to share with some of our listeners?
Well, unfortunately, no, I have not talked to them specifically about golf courses. I have talked to them about the resort stuff and residential items. But like I said, it's quite a bit different from those large swaths of grass that you have up there. It's a very difficult thing to maintain at best. But I do want to give a shout-out to the Parks Department of Maui County for bringing these guys in and actually trying to do a new perspective on chemical application and trying to build a safer and better community for all of us.
I mean, part of this initiative is to be able to see if you can maintain parks for a year, at least 4 parks, and have them be pesticide-free. What will have to change at those parks to be able to do that?
Well, it's bringing in the proper type of soil. So if you can bring in a really good compost that can boost that nutrients profile, the soil profile, to a really high level where those plants can uptake that nutrients, then you're going to have a really healthy grass and you're going to have a lot less problems with invasive species coming in and taking over. But it also has to do with irrigation. It's an entire program, you know, a holistic look at it, to where you have the entire system working properly, not just the chemical application side. It's everything from pesticides to your irrigation to basic maintenance, how you cut the grass and how often you cut the grass. So there's a lot of ways to really look at it and changing how you do these things.
As the public will be invited to at least a couple of the events over the next year or so, what is it that you think that's directly translatable to a residential situation where usually, you know, a person's going to go to the garden store and pick up various things which, you know, you haven't been using but may be easy to get and may not have the kind of time to do some of the things that you're suggesting with the soil?
That's right. Well, you know, what we're finding is if you take the time to apply these compost to your soil, you have to do it less often. So it actually takes less labor over time. You know, so it actually, you have a plus benefit there. So to me, it's really about learning the proper chemicals to use, and actually not really chemicals, like they're derivatives from organic plants. And it's picking the right thing to use in the right location at the right time. And it's that type of educational direction that we need for residential owners. Because all they have is a big box store down, you know, centrally located that's telling them, hey, you need to buy this, or, you know, or ads on the television telling them they need to buy this, but nowhere educating them on what they should really do in the bigger scheme and the bigger picture of things.
So
what Beyond Pesticides is here for.
So what are some of the examples that you would point them toward so that they don't go toward the big box? I mean, knowing the right thing to put where. That sounds a little nebulous, and for someone thinking, well, gee, I'd like to do this, but give me something specific, what would you tell them?
Well, it's really, I tell them, get onto the Beyond Pesticides website and look at the information they have, you know, or they can come and talk to me at the resort at the Westin Maui, and I can give them information. I don't mind sharing information about what they can do, but it's very site-specific. So it's, like you said, it is fairly nebulous because it depends on location of other plants, how close the grass is to your house, you know. So there's a lot of really interesting things that depend on the location-specific situation.
Duane, you're really asking people to become better gardeners in a lot of ways. But then what do you do to bring in the big box retailers? Because clearly they have products. Clearly they're being told, sell this. How do you expect to change some of their behavior?
Well, it's really, it's kind of up to the public because you know how that works. These companies will bring in whatever they feel is necessary, but if the public does not buy it, they will stop bringing it in. And if the public starts standing up and telling them, hey, listen, we want these products, we're preferring these products, they will start to bring those products in. I'm working directly with a company that used to be called Hawaii Grower Products that is now called Simplot. They bring in a lot of the organic material for me specifically because in a resort setting, we have to have specific information on these labels to be used in the public. So there's certain things I cannot use legally at my property. So I have to make sure that I use things that are resort label use. And so that's my parameters there. So that's where I go through an institution that makes sure that those things are properly labeled so that I can use them on my property.
As part of all of this too, the State Department of Transportation, the Highways Division, is going to participate in a two-week pilot program using goats.
That's correct.
For
they're
weed
going to start
management.
Out in Ulupalakua, and they're working with the ranch right now, and they're going to start working on roadside maintenance with goats. And so we're actually looking for local goat farmers or goat herders who would be willing to contact Ellie Cochran there at the county and see if they can set up contracts with the county in the near future. So that's a possible, you know, job opportunity in itself.
Kind of going back to that old adage, when everything old is new again. Thanks very much, Duane.
You're very welcome. Enjoy.
We'll wait and see how it turns out. Duane Sparkman is engineering and landscaping manager for the Westin Maui Resort and Spa. He's one of the speakers at the first of a series of trainings that start tomorrow and will kick off a one-year pesticide-free parks program at four Maui parks. The State Department of Transportation Highways Division is also going to participate with that two-week pilot program using goats for weed management on designated roadsides. And two of the events will be open to the community. If you'd like to find out more, check out our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000's Home Edition, an online tool designed for parents to strengthen the school-home connection by creating continuity between classwork and homework. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii Parents.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, traditional music meets contemporary settings with taiko master Kenny Endo. First, though, here's your backyard quiz.
Later in the program, we'll be speaking with one of the athletes on Hawaii's polo circuit. So for today's backyard quiz, we're looking at the history of polo in the islands. Hawaii is one of 13 circuits that make up the U.S. Polo Association. The Hawaii Circuit has four fields on three islands across the state. One of those, the field at Mokulaia on Oahu's North Shore, has the distinction of being the only beachfront polo field in the world. Polo first came to Hawaii in the 19th century at a time when Paniolo culture was in full swing. In fact, a cowboy visiting from foreign shores brought polo to Hawaii. Today, we want to know the country from whence that polo pioneer hailed. We'll need both his country of birth and where he was traveling from. If you know, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689.
Aloha, this is Jim Moffat. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the Conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Kenny Endo, taiko drum master, has long since established himself as an ambassador of an art form that's firmly rooted in tradition. But he's fascinated by the world of music beyond the boundaries of what has been done before, continuing to explore new sounds and influences from music all over the world. The most recent result of his 40 years of exploration in music is the Kahilu Quintet, and he's on hand in our studio with ukulele player Abe Lagrimas to tell us about it. Good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Good to have you. Kenny, as a traditional artist, you could easily have stayed within those boundaries, couldn't you?
Yeah, I think especially if I had stayed in Japan, mm-hmm. because there's a lot more context for playing traditional music and mm-hmm. more, you know, possibilities to make a living doing it.
Mm-hmm. But you know, a drum is a drum, right? You can put it in any kind of a context, and I think, in particularly with percussion instruments, they travel pretty well, don't they?
Yeah, I think all kinds of collaborations are possible. It depends on the musicians. They just have to be open to it and know what they're doing.
You were telling me about a trip to Argentina in which you got together with a marimba player, and that would be a fantastic collaboration, I would think.
Yeah, I was down there, I think it was 2008, and there's an incredible marimba player that they had me collaborate with, and I don't speak Spanish well, and he couldn't speak English, but I gave him the music and let him listen to the CD, and when he heard it, I said, it doesn't have to be like the CD, it could be just whatever you want. He just took off on it, and it was a great experience.
That sounds like one. Well, with this new Kahilu Quintet, this is a fairly new venture for you. And you've got instruments both old and new, don't you?
Yeah. During my 40-year anniversary tour a couple years ago, I had various concerts, and these days I had to travel with a fairly small group, either three or five people. So this quintet that played at the Kahilu Theater in the Big Island consisted mostly of musicians based here in Honolulu. Mm-hmm. Abe was willing to come out from L.A., although Abe's from here originally. And it just really worked well. And so when I heard Abe was coming this month, I thought it would be a great opportunity to put this group back together.
Well, let's hear some music from you and Abe. This is you on your drums and Abe on ukulele. What is this piece you're going to play?
It's a piece of mine called Clarity.
Uh-huh. Well, we'll hope for some clarity in the sound reproduction. And Abe Lagrimas on ukulele, Kenny Endo on taiko drums. Terrific. Thanks so much. Abe Lagrimas on ukulele, Kenny Endo on his taiko drums. Kenny, if I had heard that without seeing you and somebody had told me that the stringed instrument was a Japanese instrument, I would have believed him because it sounded very... I never heard an ukulele sound quite so Asian.
Thanks.
Don't you think? I mean, I think it was just the way some of the way you bent the strings a couple of times, Abe, mm-hmm. and the scale you used, but... Anyway, those two instruments seem to integrate really well. And Kenny, with this Kahilu Quintet, that's you're integrating your sound with Abe playing vibes, among other things. What other instruments have you got?
Well, Abe's quite versatile. He plays drums, vibraphones, as well as ukulele. He may even play a little taiko. We have Yichie Lai from Taiwan playing a guzheng, which is actually the predecessor to a koto, and she's another amazing musician. Todd Yukimoto's on woodwinds, and he actually makes his soprano saxophone sound like a shakuhachi sometimes.
Uh-huh.
And he's amazing.
I could see that, yeah.
Amazing improviser as well. And then there's Patrick Oye, who is originally a guitar player, is a member of my ensemble, but he's playing an instrument called the Tsugaru Shamisen and some taiko as well. So it's kind of an interesting mix.
Yeah,
and we just have to kind of leave room for each other to in playing in this temple on Sunday. It's the first time they're allowing us to do a concert in this 100-year-old temple,
mm-hmm.
and the acoustics are really amazing. So we're just going to try to keep it as natural as possible, and maybe just mic the string instruments.
Yeah, because you've got a merger of some really quiet instruments, like the ukulele with the taiko drums. Yeah,
right.
And then nobody will have any problem hearing the vibes. But and what was the other instrument you described?
The guzheng is a string instrument. It's kind of like what a koto is in Japan.
Sure, so it lays flat.
Yeah, it has 20 strings, and it has steel strings rather than nylon or silk strings. and this woman, Yichie Lai, is really an amazing master of this instrument and does not only the traditional music but modern music as well.
The sound I associate with koto is that of a string where you bend a string quite a bit, you know, you hit a note and then hit the string and the tone jumps.
Yeah, she does that as well on the guzheng.
The whole challenge had to be integrating those sounds. You don't usually hear those instruments in other contexts. Should be really interesting, Kenny. Thanks to you and Abe for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Kenny Endo's contemporary ensemble, the Kahilo Quintet, with Abe Lagrimas Jr., Todd Yokomoto, Yichen Lai, and Patrick Oye will perform this Sunday at 6 p.m. at the Shingon Shu Hawaii Temple on Sheridan Street in Honolulu. You can find out more on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Chamber Orchestra, presenting West Side Story in concert, 7:30 p.m. this Saturday and 3 p.m. Sunday at Iao Theater. Tickets at mauichamberorchestra.org and mauionstage.com.
The federal government is taking public comments about whether it should reconsider protections of 29 national monuments. Papahanao Mokuakea is one of them. CivilBeat.org reporter Kirsten Downey has the reality check. Hi there. Good to talk to you again.
Hello. How are you?
Doing all right, thanks. But we'll wait and see what happens with our monuments. Now, since Friday, people have been able to send in their comments. Do you have a sense of how many have been received and kind of what they're saying? Are you able to see that?
Well, the Trump administration reopened this process saying that they didn't think that the public had been heard. Well, now they're hearing from the public. And about 15,000 comments were filed in the first 4 days of the comment period. It opened on Friday. And I see this morning that 4,000 or 5,000 more have filed in the past 24 hours. So they're hearing from lots of people, and they're hearing from lots of people overwhelmingly who say, we love our national parks, our national monuments, and we don't want them changed.
So the idea that most of what they've been receiving so far, those thousands and thousands of letters, are saying don't change anything?
Yes, they are. It's, thus far, they're running about 100-1 at least in support of leaving the national monuments. The 29 or so monuments that are particularly in question, people are really asking for them not to be touched at all. This issue has come up because in some places around the country, local communities around these national monument areas say that the designation of these national monuments has prevented them from doing things that in the past they would have been able to do, and that could be fishing, lumber, and it can be oil and gas exploration, that kind of thing. They say they have been prevented from pursuing their traditional pursuits by the creation of national monuments. Of course, there's also a very large group of environmentalists and public-minded citizens who want to preserve as much of our natural resources as possible. And this is one of these cases where we see economic interests specifically pitted against environmental interests.
And in our local terms, that comes back to what happens with Papahanaumokuakea and some of the arguments that we've already seen with the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council. What have you heard from them? I would imagine that they would be in favor of having the changes that they've been talking about for such a long time.
Well, last summer we had a heated debate in Hawaii over the expansion of the monument. President Obama expanded it fourfold to 583,000 square miles. This was warmly applauded by many people in Hawaii and many environmentalists who said it's essential for us to take steps now to start preserving our reefs and fishing areas. On the other hand, people like Westpac have opposed it, and they are preparing their comments. So we haven't seen the last of this debate. The comment period is open until July 10th. People can send in their comments at regulations.gov, and people's voices will be heard. But it is my belief that we'll see a lot more debate in the next 2 months over this fascinating issue.
And Kirsten, before you go, has there ever been a case where a monument has been summarily reversed?
No, it's never happened before, and that's why it's been so controversial.
All right. Well, we're going to wait and see. Thanks very much for bringing the reality check to us today. Talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org, today featuring reporter Kirsten Downey. By now you know that last Friday, the WannaCry ransomware took over tens of thousands of computers in 150 countries worldwide. Since then, most of what we've learned has centered on the tech angle. Deeper geopolitical implications have emerged over the last 24 hours. A Google security researcher is pointing to a North Korean link between the current hack and the Lazarus hack that invaded Sony Pictures in 2014. Then there are the reports that many computers in China were vulnerable to the attack, bringing additional questions about the role of states in cyber warfare. We called Chris McNally for his take on the emerging story. He's professor of political economy at Chaminade University and an adjunct senior fellow at the East-West Center. Chris McNally is on the line with us now. Aloha.
Aloha.
As you look at this situation, and clearly this is so new into it, and it's going to become increasingly more nuanced, but with what you're seeing now and these fingers pointing back to North Korea, how do you look at this situation from a geopolitical perspective?
Well, at first, we're not quite sure that really North Korea is behind it. All they did is find source code in this attack that is similar to those attacks that have been traced back to North Korea. However, it wouldn't be astonishing at all. But the irony of it all is that this is something that came out of the National Security Administration, a U.S. agency, then was probably released by a Russia-based group, shadow brokers, online, made open to everybody, and then taken up by somebody, perhaps the North Koreans, and turned around into a ransomware attack. It wouldn't be astonishing if it was North Korea. They have perpetrated other attacks. One of the most successful probably was an attack on the Bangladeshi Central Bank that netted something like $81 million in returns. And that just shows you how cash-strapped the North Korean government is. They really want to get their hands on dollars, and they basically use any method to do so. By the way, North Korea has been implicated in counterfeiting currency, U.S. dollars in particular in the past, as well as in the drug trade and making artificial drugs such as methamphetamines and others.
You're also bringing up a point, though, that because obviously this is so early into the investigation, that there may be a difference between North Korea as the country and North Korean actors who may be involved with this. How much of a link do you think there is between those North Korean actors potentially and the country itself, given what you've just said?
Well, in North Korea, the actors are probably very tightly aligned with the state. The state itself will probably keep them in a separate unit to basically deny any involvement. But in North Korea, probably nobody can get this kind of sophistication, resources, and access to the internet without having state backing. The situation in Russia and China, often the other culprits in cyber warfare attacks, are much more murky. There are various groups in both China and Russia that are not very closely aligned with the state. They might be at times working with certain security agencies of the state, but at other times they might just be doing it for profit. So the situation is much grayer than in the case of North Korea. In North Korea, if it was perpetrated by this Lazarus group, this group is probably backed by the North Korean state.
How much irony do you find in the fact that there are many, many, many computers in China which were vulnerable to the WannaCry attack, and the fact that this may be perpetuated and perpetrated by North Korean actors?
Well, that will be an interesting to see what happens then between China and North Korea, if it really turns out that North Korea was behind that. But as we know, the relationship between China and North Korea is not an easy one. China is the only backer of North Korea. It doesn't want North Korea to collapse. But on the other hand, the Chinese central government is not happy about what is happening in North Korea, especially the missile tests and the nuclear program, as well as things like cyber attacks. But the reason that China was hit so hard is that a lot of people run bootleg copies of Windows, and especially the older versions, the XP version of Windows, that really were the victims in this particular attack. And once Microsoft sent out its first security patch in March, those that were running bootlegged versions of Windows did not get them. They don't have access to them, and they don't even have access to them now. So you have to run a legal copy of it. But then this also does show that Windows is a very, very leaky program with enormous amounts of vulnerabilities. So there's a lot of blame to go around. I mean, everybody seems to be at fault here to some extent, including the U.S. government, obviously hacker groups, Microsoft, people themselves who either have downloaded this or were in networks that were infected, and so on.
So what would you expect states that have been affected to do about it when clearly, cyber warfare seems to be where we're going in terms of how countries can be able to affect another one?
Well, the first thing they'll have to do is obviously increase the defenses. Actually, the state hardest hit was the United Kingdom, especially its National Health Service. That was probably the most influential part of this attack. Otherwise, actually, the attackers have netted very little in terms of ransom payments, and the disruption has been not very large. There's been disruption, but it's been not, life-threatening or really caused enormous amounts of damage. In the case of China, the government itself is obviously upping its rhetoric that they would like to have a much more diverse market for operating systems. The world basically is reliant on Windows. Microsoft has somewhat of a monopoly, and the product is not that good, especially the older versions. So the Chinese all along wanted to diversify, use Linux-based systems and other systems. They've tried to develop their own operating software, but they really were never up to speed. They couldn't compete with Microsoft. They might reinforce such efforts, but overall it just means people have to be a lot more careful, including institutions and individuals, not just governments.
Before we let you go, I want to ask you about Bitcoin. Does Bitcoin have any responsibility in this?
Bitcoin is a really interesting... This is an interesting question you're asking, Bethan. This is really interesting that, the people who are perpetrating this attack are using Bitcoin as a payment. Obviously, one can still track who actually then receives the payment. I mean, again, one can go into the codes and look at that. And I suspect that Bitcoin is a bit of a phenomenon that exists for the time being, but if it continues to be used for such purposes, I suspect various governments around the world will start to clamp down on it a lot more. Interestingly, Bitcoin has been most used in China. And the Chinese government, in various instances, has started to clamp down, basically making it impossible to convert Bitcoin into Chinese yuan or renminbi, the Chinese currency. So my gut feeling is that Bitcoin kind of exists at the pleasure of the world's governments, and the major governments are probably going to start to clamp down on it and its use if such, you know, attacks continue that use Bitcoin for their ransom payments.
Do you think that the way they clamp down on Bitcoin will be done individually or as a concerted effort?
Another very interesting question. I suspect so far it's been individual. There has been no concerted effort. The Chinese have been at the forefront, mainly because Bitcoin has been used most in China. Over time, I suspect there could be a concerted effort, especially if such uses become a lot more common. And it would be quite easy to basically say Bitcoin is not legal tender and you're not allowed to convert Bitcoin into any of the major currencies. And that would be basically, you know, end of game.
A complete shutdown.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for giving us your take, at least at this early stage. And I appreciate the fact that you're able to join us.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bethann.
Chris McNally is a professor of political economy at Chaminade University. He's also adjunct senior fellow at the East-West Center. His research focuses on comparative capitalisms, especially the nature and logic of China's capitalist transition and Sino-capitalism.
Aloha, I'm Melina Lilios, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's backyard quiz, we thought about the origins of polo in Hawaii. We asked you to name the country from which Hawaii's polo Prometheus hailed. Hawaii was fertile ground for the introduction of such a sport when polo arrived at the end of the 19th century. Paniola culture had been going strong for several decades, meaning that there was a strong horse culture and a base of riding skill. The drama, excitement, and difficulty of polo was a natural fit for the Paniolos of Hawaii's cattle ranches. From those early days, polo has grown into a full-fledged institution. The Hawaiian Islands Polo Association is one of 13 circuits that comprise the U.S. Polo Association. The Hawaii circuit includes four fields, one on the small windward Oahu town of Waimanalo, another on the slopes of upcountry Maui and Makaua'au, the world's only beachfront field at Mokulea, on Oahu's north shore, and a fourth on a leeward slope of Mauna Kea. That robust presence began with humble origins when an Australian cowboy visiting from India brought polo to Hawaii. Those were the answers to today's quiz. Nobody got them. I guess that's what happens when you ask you a toughie. But we'll be back tomorrow with another one, and we'll see how you do. And if you've got a backyard quiz for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Santiago Santi Torres is a rare bird, a polo prodigy who was not born into the kind of privilege you usually need to build a career in the sport of kings. He's been a polo star since his early teens. He's in Hawaii to play with the Hawaii Polo Club, is rated a 7-goal player, and he's with us in our studio to explain just what that means. Good morning, Santi.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
All right. When you say 7-goal player, you're talking about 7 goals out of a possible 10. That's a ranking, and that determines how a tournament is conducted, right?
Right, right. The ratings are from 0 to 10, and based on your rating, they make tournaments, and your team has to add up to the goal rating that tournament is.
So in a 20-goal tournament, your four players would have to have a combined 20 or better rating, is that right?
20 max in a 20-goal tournament.
So 20 max.
Right. 20 or below.
Uh-huh.
So if I was playing, I would be 7, and I would, my other three players would have to add up to 13.
What kind of, those ratings being applied to you, how are they judged?
There's a rating committee that watches you throughout the year as you play. They travel, watch everyone, and once a year you get rated.
What are the kind of skills that they're looking for?
They're looking at how you ride, how you position yourself, how you hit the ball, how you play with your team, a little bit of everything.
What are the things that, for instance, what kind of skills are called for in playing with a team?
Passing, obviously, how well you hit the ball, positioning yourself, and you have to be the first one to get to the ball to score, so anticipation.
That makes sense. Do you, do you have a regular team that you play with, or do you find yourself going, working with a lot of different people?
Yeah, it's kind of different in polo. If you're lucky, you get year contracts, but a lot of us switch around season to season.
So a lot of times in a match, you'll be with players that you haven't worked with before.
Right. Yeah, each seasons change, teams change. People go up in handicap, people go down in handicap. Mm-hmm. So it always changes unless you have a contract with one team for a couple of years.
So that means there's a lot of involves a lot of reading of your fellow players as well as your opponents.
Yes, and you get used to playing with different people, and you're always playing with someone new. So that's cool.
Because as you said, anticipation being a big part of it. If you know somebody well, a fellow player well, you can get into a little bit of that. Yeah.
No, for sure. And that's what the bigger organizations try to do is make contracts with some players, and that player gets better and better over the years, so they're not always switching around.
Mm-hmm.
But, like I said, it's cool. You meet a bunch of different guys and play with a bunch of different guys, but sometimes it can also go against you because the teams don't always work out.
How'd you get such an early start in the sport? Which you did, right?
Yes. I was actually born into it. My father and my mother played, and I liked it since I was little. My big brother also plays, so.
So you grew up with plenty of horses around.
Oh yeah, a lot of them.
Yeah,
Dad
bet.
Had a lot of horses, and I love it. So it's a plus.
Well, what are the kind of skills that you want to acquire to if somebody were to be maybe a skilled horseman but wanted to learn the game, how would you go about that?
First off, it's good to be a horseman. It's good to know the horse, and because you can't talk to them, so it's good to know how to read their minds or connect with them, because mm-hmm. They're a wild animal, just like any other animal, and that you teach, and they also teach you a lot. But that's one of the main things to start. And then ball skill from there and learning how to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
That's up to you after that. But the main thing is to get along with the horse and read them.
Which you have to do as somebody who travels a lot. You can't always take your ponies with you, can you?
Right. Like this weekend, I'm going to play here. And I'm playing Mike Daly's horses. But for me, it's normal because I've been playing since I was little. So it's like anyone who's been playing a sport since they were little. You get used to it. And like I said, you get to know the horses and different personalities they have. So it's all good.
What kind of different personalities do they have?
Like us. Some are crazy.
Is that right?
Some get nervous. Some you just got to work with them. I'm not crazy, but some can be mean. Some want to bite you. So.
Yeah.
But
have you gotten pretty good at reading them over the years?
Yeah. I mean, it's a never ending. You always learn every day. You learn something new with them. But, no, I get along with them really well.
You know, in a sport like, say, basketball, where you have a regular team and they're, you know, basically going up and down a field to go after a goal, you can run plays, right? There are five of you on the field, and there's certain prearranged plays, pick and roll, that kind of thing.
Right.
Is there anything comparable in polo?
Sorry?
Does polo have anything like that where you can, you know, sort of have something slightly prearranged that you're going to do?
Yeah, I mean, before the games, you speak with your team. Some people have coaches. And like I said, with anticipation, the ball is faster than the horse. If once you hit the ball will pass everyone way faster than the horse can run.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where positioning comes in and your team plays. Each player has a jersey on and from 1 through 4, and we kind of play our positions. 1 and 2 are more forward, and 3 sets up the team a little more, and 4 is the back door.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I mean it's like other sports where you make plays and passes, and so every person has their position.
Because let's say if you hit a long shot downfield, you want somebody down there,
right? And that's where your 1 and 2 come in, and they they push forward and open plays for the back guys to make the passes.
Mm-hmm. So if you usually play as a 4, is that something you would consistently do?
Me as a 4?
Right, yeah, anyone who was, say...
Oh, on the field, yes. Like when the ball goes out, there's a knock-in behind the goal,
mm-hmm.
and usually the number 4 is the back, so they bring in the ball, and then the other 3 players make a play. Some of them pick for each other,
mm-hmm.
like pick a man, and then whoever's loose gets the pass.
Makes sense. Sounds like fun, Santiago. Thanks a lot.
I like playing forward, but any position is fun.
I bet it is. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
Santi Torres was the subject of a documentary film, The Polo Kid, when he was 13, and played for Team USA while still in his early teens. Today, he's rated a 7-goal player. He'll be playing with the Hawaii Polo Club this Sunday in Mokulea.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
As always, there's a lot going on around the state, and more than we can keep up with sometimes. That's why Morning Edition host and our colleague Derek Malama joins us to look at events in our community that are going on under the radar. Under the radar. The radio.
Okay.
Hi, Derek.
Hello, Chris.
The Waikiki Aquarium is hosting a free talk on tides.
Yes, Matthew Gosner. Gonser from UHC Grant will speak on king tides, which are the very highest tides. Hawaii Sea Grant is asking citizen scientists to document today's high water level events to better understand tomorrow's impacts from sea level rise and other coastal high water events. The program says that first-person experiences and visuals reinforce that climate impacts are local in nature and not just a distant phenomenon. You can learn more about this developing program at 3:30 p.m. tomorrow in the Waikiki Aquarium, and it's free.
That sounds good. And on Molokai, you can hear some free music tomorrow.
Yes, the Molokai Instrumental Music Program under the direction of Bob Underwood will feature adults and elementary school music students performing a variety of songs. This concert is free and open to the public. It's at St. Damien's Catholic Church in Kaunakakai from 6 to 7 p.m. tomorrow, and it's free.
And on the Big Island, there's an evening of music and hula from Kupuna.
Yes. The group is called Haunani's Aloha Expressions, and with their handmade colorful costumes and lei, these kupuna have competed at and won various hula festivals, and they bring to life the golden memories of Hawaii. And this is happening in the Kilauea Visitor Center Auditorium from 6:30 to 8 p.m. tomorrow. And it's free.
And it's free, which is a pretty golden memory.
Oh, yes. Remember those days when everything was free?
Vaguely, yeah. Thanks a lot, Derek.
Thank you, Chris.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. And you can always find out more at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Thanks so much for joining us today for the conversation. Now, tomorrow, Mental Health America President and CEO Paul Gianfrido will be here. He's in Honolulu to keynote at this week's NAMI Hawaii State Conference.
And pianist Sarah Cahill comes to Maui for a contemporary music concert.
You can comment about anything you hear on the program on our talkback line. That's 808-792-8217. Or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find us on Facebook at The Conversation or on Twitter at HI Conversation. Find me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed part of The Conversation or any other show that we air, you can find them on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Let's meet up tomorrow for more of The Conversation.